You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
With almost 22 million people, the Indian city of Delhi is the second most populous urban region in the world. To give you a sense of scale, the Newark urban area is the fourth. Delhi is growing more rapidly than any other city or any in North America or Europe. So how are Indians experiencing this explosive growth, especially those who seem to benefit from it? Rana Dasgupta explores that question in his latest book, Capital, The Eruption of Delhi. It's published by the Penguin Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Rana Dasgupta back to our show. Hello.
Hello there.
Your first book, Tokyo Cancelled, consisted of a cycle of stories told by people stranded in an airport. First of all, this is your first work of nonfiction, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
The second one was a novel that brought you here.
That's
called
right.
Solo.
Yeah.
Have you always written nonfiction?
I haven't really. I mean, I've written essays from time to time, but this was a book I started after I'd been living in Delhi for 10 years and writing about other places in fictional ways. And I thought it was time for me to really take stock of the amazing changes that I'd seen around me in that period.
Are you doing something comparable here with tales of actual people in Delhi to what you did on Tokyo Cancelled?
To some extent, but I found that for this particular project, I needed to really go out and research and write it as a piece of nonfiction so that people would have to take it seriously, because some of these stories are quite bizarre and incredible, and I felt that if it was a novel, people would just feel I'd made it all up, which I haven't. The reality is actually like that.
You focus on what you call the flourishing bourgeoisie. Who are they?
Well, there is the new Indian middle class is sort of much used internationally as well. And there is, of course, a collection of people, possibly about 10% of the population, who have become much wealthier over the last two decades since the economy was opened up to global capital in 1991, and who's at the top end of that group, their lifestyles approximate those of the middle classes of the West.
In the United States and Europe, there's been a lot of debate over inequality, the conditions for the poorest and the excesses of the wealthiest. There's a film opening this week called Siddharth about a family that lives in the crowded Malviya and Nagar area of Delhi on 250 rupees, that's $4 a day. Are you more concerned with the spectrum of the people in between?
Inequality is a huge aspect of all this. And though my book focuses largely on the middle classes, because I think it's interesting both locally and globally to know what kind of world those people are trying to build, because they will have significant influence on everyone's lives in the world. There are also chapters about the very poorest people in the city.
There's still a lot of illiterate people in India, despite the fact that this is a booming economy.
Correct. And the fact that these two groups of people cohabit the same space is, I think, one of the realities that we have to deal with more and more in the 21st century. Great dispossession sits quite comfortably, it unfortunately appears, with great wealth and achievement.
There's a field of scholarship called subaltern studies, focusing on post-colonial societies and the role of non-elites in political and social change. Do you see yourself contributing to that?
I know much of the work of that group of people, which is quite fantastic. And one of the things that body of work has sort of brought to our attention is the feeling that what happens in outside the West is not simply a recapitulation of things that have already happened in the West. The kinds of futures that are being built in places like India need to be studied on their own terms. And I think one of the things that my book sort of shows us is that what is happening with the spread of global capitalism is not some story of homogenization. Places remain very different from each other. And the way that people interpret capitalism and live it out is very different in India than it is, say, in the US. And to some extent, I think the world is becoming stranger to people who live in the West. Very wealthy and influential societies are emerging that look nothing like America or Europe, and have very different ideas of what kind of world they want to live in.
In the past, we thought of growing economies as kind of playing catch-up to the West.
Exactly.
And now there's something, we're seeing it as something totally different.
That's right.
But even in India, you have contrast. Mumbai is the wealthiest city in India, home of Tata Motors, which owns Jaguar, the most expensive residence in the world. So why did you choose Delhi instead of Mumbai?
Well, Delhi, Mumbai in some sense is, I say at the beginning of my book that Calcutta was the city of the 19th century, the British capital. Mumbai,
also the intellectual center.
Especially in its own eyes, oh. Yes. Mumbai was the capital of the 20th century, the center of cinema and banking and commerce. And Delhi is the 21st century center of India. And the reason I say that is because Delhi money is a much more uncanny sort of money than Mumbai money. It's money that's arisen from the nexus of business and politics. Delhi resembles Moscow much more than it resembles New York, and so it's a new kind of experience of wealthy societies where you don't really know where money has come from or how it's being produced, but its effects are all around you, and this kind of city and society is something that I feel gives us a new sort of experience of capitalism.
Mumbai is the financial center, but are money and government inseparable in Delhi?
Yes. I mean, the reason why lots of business moved to Delhi over the last 20 or 30 years was because they were the kind of businesses that needed to be close to politics if they were to grow, especially in the pre-1991 era where the state had a lot of controls over business. After 1991, the rewards of those people who were deeply networked with politics became much greater, several orders of magnitude greater. You could turn your relationships with politics into monopolies over big industrial sectors, as in Moscow. And so some of those people have become wealthy on a global scale and are now turning their attention to other places like Africa.
Will things change now that Narendra Modi is the new prime minister?
They will undoubtedly change.
He's a Hindu nationalist. Do you think that appeals to Indians who may feel that something is being lost with India's growth or also that they're being left out?
Yes, I mean, Modi is a very complex subject. I mean, he comes in using the language of a CEO to describe the kind of reforms that he will make, and all the noises he makes are of that sort, of improving management and efficiency and all these sorts of things. And so this appeals very much to the business community who are one of the important audiences of his prime ministership. There is also a sense, I think, you're right, in that very fast change has led to various kinds of sort of retrogressive ideologies, especially with respect to religion and gender and things like this. And so there is a kind of very wide appeal of this message of, on the one hand, ideological traditionalism, and on the other, a very dynamic kind of capitalist developmentalism.
Modi is a Hindu nationalist. Do you think that, how does that play with the fact that almost 12% of Delhi's population is Muslim, of 1.5 million people? Have they experienced positive things from this eruption that you refer to in your title?
Muslims have, I would say that, I mean, Muslims have been, many of the Muslims are among the poorest people in Delhi, and the poor have generally suffered greatly over the last couple of decades. It's interesting to hear the last slot about churches being converted into condominiums. The Delhi story is slums being converted into condominiums. And these slums were, I mean, it may be difficult for your listeners to imagine what kind of landscape this is. I mean, these slums are intricately built townships, which have been built over 30 or 40 years by people of all kind of faiths and backgrounds. They've built brick houses, they've built temples and schools, they've organized electricity connections and built sewer systems. And these supplied a lot of the manual labor, domestic labor of the city, and were in many ways a kind of hospitable place for poor people arriving from the countryside to arrive in. But those sites have largely been cleared out over the last decade and converted into real estate for big companies. So there's been a transfer of wealth from the poorest to the richest members of society. And the poor have been moved very far out of the city, which has been devastating for many of their lives.
My guest is Rana Dasgupta. His book, Capital, The Eruption of Delhi, published by Penguin Press. How much of Delhi's economic growth has been accompanied by a corporate culture from the West? Are workplaces modeled on American or European ones? Or should I assume, based on what you said earlier, that India is now developing oligarchs of the sort that we've seen in Russia?
Both things are true. Both things are happening. One of the reasons for Delhi's growth in the last couple of decades is that Bombay filled up. And there was very little space for it to expand. It had the sea all around it.
So you're still calling it Bombay instead of Mumbai?
People call it both. I call it both. Delhi, on the other hand, was surrounded by farmland, and so new suburbs grew up where businessmen went and acquired lots of farmland. And many American companies, international firms, moved into the neighborhood of Delhi, and so there are very large corporations. Microsoft has its headquarters there, for instance, which are employing many, many people. And so there is, yes, a very significant local corporate workforce.
And you mentioned that the previous ideals that were in the city have withered with the arrival of the new institutions of global capitalism. What were the old ideals?
Well, after independence and under the prime ministership of Nehru, Delhi became the center of a kind of utopianism of nation building.
With a socialist ideal.
A socialist ideal where frugality and service to the country were very important, and a lot of prestige was given to people who chose to live their lives in those kind of ways. It was also a city of refugees, people who'd fled partition from small towns and large towns in West Punjab, and come to settle on the Indian side of the border after the two countries were divided, Pakistan and India. And so those people brought with them lots of a sort of neighborliness, which came from small towns and things like that. The city has been riven by a lot of trauma in the years ensuing, which has made people much more concerned with their own security and suspicious of the city at large. And today we have a very individualistic and acquisitive city, very concerned with individual advancement and money, which is not just my observation. It's people, even people who've made lots of money, are very concerned about the kind of changes in mores in their society around them.
Do you think that some of the fondness for old ideals might be the kind of nostalgia we hear in New York City? People talking about the good old Times Square as opposed to what we have now, all the new construction along the rivers that have changed the face of all five boroughs.
Well, change is always ambiguous, and it's just that. And so there are lots of people are much happier. And in a way, India is not a nostalgic place. I mean, this is one of the things that's very exciting about living there, is that most people feel that that the 21st century is going to be better than the 20th. The 20th was not that great for lots of people. There were lots of very significant moments of catastrophe. So I think people are quite invested in the future, and they're not thinking much about the past. And that's one of the things that gives that place so much energy.
Does the disruption the uprooting of slums also create a political goal, breaking up possible political or social coalitions?
Yes.
Because that's what happened in New York City. Some areas were broken up for just that reason.
Yes. And one of the things that happens when they're resettled is that the members of those large communities are separated so that those coalitions can't happen. And deliberately people from different castes and religions are settled next to each other so that any kinds of large-scale activism are very difficult to organize.
My guest is Rana Dasgupta. His book, Capital, The Eruption of Delhi, published by Penguin Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Rana Dasgupta. His latest book, his first work of nonfiction, is called Capital, The Eruption of Delhi. It's published by Penguin Press. Are men and women flourishing roughly equally as Delhi grows?
Of course, it's a big question, the question of men and women. And one of the things that I think might be an sort of unpredictable effect of these very, very rapid changes. And I think it's important to sort of have a sense of just how rapid those changes are. I mean, 15, 20 years ago, a lot of people had never left the country, didn't have telephones in their homes. There were lots of very basic things. Now, middle-class women didn't generally work until relatively recently. Now, all those things have changed. People are living in a very, very different world. Their world is very, very different from their parents and even from people 10 years either side of them. And one of the unpredictable effects of this has been to introduce many new tensions into the relationships between men and women. Men and women, in a sense, have actually flourished equally in the workplace. Women have suddenly gone out of middle-class homes in large numbers to work. But men are not necessarily happy about it. Even when they enjoy the dual income, the sense of what a marriage is and what a family should look like has changed too quickly for a lot of men, and they're quite anxious about it.
But I don't see how that leads to what newspapers have dubbed Delhi as India's rape capital. Do you see a connection between what you've called the war against women and Delhi's economic growth?
I do, because I think for a lot of people, the image of women out on the streets clearly leading their own lives, economically independent, dressing in Western clothes, is something that introduces great anxieties about the direction of Indian society and the place of men in it. And so I feel that a lot of the attacks on women, some of which have been sort of internationally notorious, have been a kind of, I would call it almost a lynching, a sort of punishment for a scapegoating of women for a lot of the anxieties that rapid change has produced.
You told me when you came in that there was a passage that you would like to read that illustrates many of the things you want to talk about. Would you read it for us now?
Yes, this is. I made a trip to a Bentley showroom. There are big, very, very expensive cars are one of the conspicuous aspects of Delhi's new wealth, and so I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs about my conversation with the PR girls who were assigned to kind of talk to me. They say to me, "When someone comes in here looking to buy a Bentley, we don't ask him what he's driving now. Just because he drives a BMW doesn't mean he can afford a Bentley. We ask if he has a jet or a yacht. We ask if he has an island." "Are there many people with jets in Delhi?" I ask. The girls wax apoplectic. "Everyone has one. And not just one, they have two, three or four." I ask the Philistines question, "What's the point of spending 30 million rupees, $600,000, on a car that can do over 300 kilometers per hour in a city where the traffic doesn't move?" They tell me about the car club that meets at night in the diplomatic enclave, where the roads are straight, wide and empty. "You have to have at least like a BMW or a Mercedes to join. They meet at midnight and they race their cars. The Prime Minister's office is always calling us to complain." "Why?" "Because the Prime Minister can't sleep. These engines make so much noise they keep him awake. So he calls us to complain, but obviously there's nothing we can do." As I drive away, I cannot help thinking of Prime Minister Manmohan Singh tossing and turning in bed, his snowy hair unturbaned on the pillow, his dreams interrupted by the rich boys' Ferraris screaming up and down the roads outside. Manmohan Singh is, of course, the man who long ago, as finance minister, opened the window to the storm of global capitalism and set the course for this new oligarchic elite.
Now, you've called your book Capital, which, of course, reminds us of, even though it's a pun, Delhi is the capital of India, reminds us of Karl Marx, and also recently Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. Did you think about that when you were coming up with this title? You must.
Well, I thought about Marx, obviously. Piketty's book wasn't out. They came out at the same time, and we exchanged emails humorously on this subject. I mean, it's an interesting parallel because, to some extent, the world that he paints in his book and the prognosis that he makes that possibly capitalism might settle into a stable state which resembles Europe at the end of the 19th century, where you have a small and extremely wealthy and stable elite, and a large majority that is pretty much powerless to improve its economic situation. In a way, my book sort of illustrates this, becomes almost a kind of morality tale about precisely this kind of situation. I think one of the things it's important to realize when one looks at places like India, emerging economies, is that it's no longer appropriate to think of them as primitive versions of something else, primitive versions, for instance, of America. They are clearly 21st century economies. The way people make their money are 21st century ways, and the ways that rich and poor are structured are very 21st century ways as well. The poor of India are just as globalized as the rich. They are working for international production. And so I think the picture I paint in my book of this very self-confident elite and a majority that has real problems getting a foothold in this new market, global market, is not just capitalism at a sort of former stage. It's capitalism in a very, very contemporary manifestation.
My guest is Rana Dasgupta. His book, Capital, The Eruption of Delhi, published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Marx argued that workers are alienated under capitalism. Do you think that people in Delhi are experiencing a sense of alienation?
There is. My book talks about widespread alienation of all kinds, not necessarily even the ways that Marx talks about it. I think it's another very fascinating aspect of the moment that we live in, that possibly half the world spent half or nearly all of the 20th century being told that capitalism was the root of all evil. And then they all became capitalist. And we shouldn't imagine that that was psychologically simple, to suddenly embrace that which was already always ruled out as evil and other. It actually has many... there are many kind of anxieties and tensions associated with that. And so even the richest people in my book have lots of sleepless nights over the fact that they are now tainted in lots of ways. And the exorcism of all the spiritual ill effects of money and earning it and spending it and thinking about it actually preoccupies many of the people in the book.
Despite the rise of capitalism in India, you say Delhi's fantasies are futile. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think it...
Is the city moving backwards and forward at the same time?
I think that, you know, one of the other things that people were told about capitalism is that it produces immense inequality. This is what socialist societies told the people, that capitalism may produce lots of goodies, but it allows a small elite to exploit everyone else, and it's evil and terrible. So I think one of the things that happens when those societies then become capitalist is that they see inequality and oppression, and they it's entirely predictable. They say, well, this is what we were always told capitalism will look like, and it does. So in a way, I think the motivation in a society like that is not to fight for equality, because that's clearly not going to happen in a capitalist society. The motivation is simply to be one of the lucky guys who's on top.
But in India, socialist India, for many years, caste was still a powerful factor in the way the society and the culture functioned. Has that changed at all?
It still is. It still is very, very.
So that exacerbates the effects of capitalism, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean this is India brings many of its own forms of inequality to an already very unequal system. I mean, you know, there are always counter energies in all these things. I mean, India is also a place of immense sort of mythological and cultural resources, and a place which is surprisingly gentle in many ways. I mean, when we look at the huge numbers of people who are leaving the countryside to enter the city, one of the things that's striking about it is just how non-violent it is compared to what happened in England, say, in the 19th century. Levels of incarceration or whatever are very low in comparison to that. But this is a society of great and possibly deepening inequalities, and it raises all kinds of issues that are really global questions about the nature of the system we're living in.
Some of your descriptions of Delhi, especially driving, sound like they come from J.G. Ballard, drivers fighting for space, people sleeping on the raised central division of the road. Do people just accept that as a cost of living in a growing city?
I think that car culture, there are many aspects to your question, but I mean, car culture has rapidly taken over.
Even if you don't own a Bentley.
Even if you don't own a Bentley, there are other options. So yes, I mean, but it's recently reached, in the last few years, it's reached crisis points. So moving around by car is now very difficult, and the city is very polluted. But if you're asking about accepting the presence of great poverty, I mean, I think this is a very complex question, because you can ask the same question of people in this country. The poor of Delhi are doing work like producing textiles, which are sold in the Western High Street. They don't only belong to local elites, if belong is the right word. They belong to the global economy. And so the question of whether they're near to you or far away from you, I think the moral question is the same. We are all connected to the poorest people on the planet.
Must the people in the growing bourgeoisie and up all speak English?
The language of corporate culture in India is definitely English, though most people in it would speak several other languages informally or at home or whatever. But the people who've made lots of money, business people, entrepreneurs, are not necessarily from the anglicized classes. One of the things that's happening increasingly in India is a sort of is a rise of people who speak other languages, whose entrepreneurial skills are often greater than those of the more sort of elite. And we now, of course, have a prime minister who's decided to conduct his meetings in Hindi, because as I suspect, a kind of ideological maneuver.
When you see this kind of rapid growth, there's usually a generation gap that develops. Is that a serious problem in India right now, younger people being so different from their parents, often, as you pointed out earlier, leaving villages, coming to the city and becoming very urbanized?
Yes, it's a huge issue. I think parents are frightened of not understanding their children or not being appreciated by their children, because they feel that they may have no value in the kind of the universe that their children are building. So, for instance, it happens in many ways. I mean, one of the things that's a very sensitive sort of fault line between generations is the question of whether you live, of how you live with families and how you marry. So traditionally, parents lived with their eldest son. And part of the reason that Hindu families especially are so preoccupied by having male children is for this reason. Male children are supposed to provide security in old age. Part of the lifestyle that is sold in advertising and all this sort of thing is the lifestyle of nuclear families, of families living only in two generations, not three. And many, though not all, successful young people have chosen to do this, and they kind of move into apartments that are designed with this kind of lifestyle in mind. And this creates great tensions between generations.
Just one more thing before you go. When your father was a child in Delhi in the 1950s, 1.7 million people lived there. Today, over 20 million people do. Does anybody believe that kind of growth is sustainable economically or socially?
I think that the growth of Delhi is probably plateauing, as it is in many of these great megalopolises around the world. And I think the UN projects that most of the urbanization that's going to happen over the next 20 or 30 years is going to be in medium-sized cities, because the rewards to people moving into cities of 20 million or more just taper off. But it's surprising that when one lives in the cities of those sorts, to realize that it can actually happen peacefully and relatively harmoniously, even if it looks chaotic from the outside.
Well, among the people you write about are psychoanalysts, so obviously they are needed to help people make that transition.
Yes. Well, they're a growing breed, and they have amongst the most fascinating stories, because there are great depths of experience below all these things. This is a place in the world, like many other emerging countries, that suffered immensely in the 20th century. If we think of all the famines and political violence and wars that have afflicted the places that are now kind of rising to positions of influence in the global economy, people from these emerging countries bring very, very different experiences to the capitalist table than Americans or Europeans have, especially Americans. So there's a lot of stuff to work out.
Rana Dasgupta's book, Capital, The Eruption of Delhi, is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.